owns the farmland, and what does that mean for our access to healthy, locally grown food, climate change, and inequality?
There's a farm crisis, but there's part of that is also that there's a farmland crisis. So when it comes to America's like private farmlands, there's been like a massive concentration of land ownership since the Great Recession. So I think the land holdings of America's like 100 largest private owners has increased from 28 million to like 42 million acres just since 2008. And some of these owners include, you know, timber companies or big farm companies, as well as like conservation groups, Ted Turner, Bill Gates. And we have like an estimated 370 million acres of farmland that's like expected to change hands by 2035 as an old generation of farmers retire and just like need to sell off the main source of wealth that they own. But the problem is that small farmers, you know, who grow table food, small farmers from marginalized communities, like the Somali Bantu farmers in Maine, they're just being outbid by big corporations and like financial investors. They just simply don't have the cash to compete in this market.
That's Audrey Lim. We talk with her about her terrific book, Free the Land, How We Can Fight Poverty and Climate Chaos. Then we rebroadcast our 2009 interview with Carlene Madigan about her book, The Backyard Homestead. It was so successful, it went on to spark a whole series of the Backyard Homestead books from Story Press. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Land, how a society owns, stewards, and controls it, is at the core of what kind of society it is. Is land viewed as something for use but not appropriation? Something held in common, or something owned and controlled by some while excluding others? And what about those whose use of the land was ripped away, as happened to the original inhabitants of America? Or those who were given a promise of land that was never fulfilled, like the former slaves who were promised 40 acres and a mule? And what happens when more and more land for growing food is bought up by private equity firms that care nothing about food, but only profit? Finally, how can land be taken back by the dispossessed? My guest, Andrea Lim, explores these and other questions, most notably their bearing on our age of climate chaos, in her book, Free the Land. It's an eye-opening examination of how treating land as a source of profit has a massive impact on racial inequality and the housing, gentrification, and environmental crises. Audrey Lim, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This is just a terrific book, Free the Land, How We Can Fight Poverty and Climate Chaos, although it's about much more than climate. But that is, of course, an important and central theme. You write that the book grew from your realization that the commodification of land is driving many of America's most intransigent problems: ecological collapse, climate change, systemic racism, the housing crisis, economic inequality. The book is about a lot more than the climate, as I said, but since that's right in your title, why don't we start there? You open the book with a visit to the tar sands of your native Alberta. Describe first what you saw.
Yeah, so this was about 10 years ago. I was basically reporting on the climate crisis and the social movements that were coalescing around it. So Indigenous movements, you know, Indigenous water protector movements against pipelines and oil developments. And so, yeah, as you mentioned, I was going up to the Canadian tar sands, not far from where I grew up. These are just really giant, really vast mines, really, that cover. It's in an area where it used to be boreal forest, and it's just these like giant canyons, grand canyons of mines with these giant, you know, apartment-sized machines that like dig up the ground and try to get to that semi-solid oil, the tar sands that's underneath it. So, you know, 10 years ago, climate talk, or the way that we talked about climate change, was really focused on fossil fuel consumption and the carbon emissions that went along with it and global temperature rise. But of course, the indigenous water protectors, the activists, the just people who were a part of these indigenous nations in the region, they were talking about their opposition to these oil developments and their involvement with the climate movement. They were talking about it in terms of land, you know, so like the land was stolen from them. These indigenous nations, the First Nations, still had treaty rights over these lands that the oil developments were, I mean, they claimed that these oil developments were a violation of their treaty rights, which, you know, even though the land is no longer completely owned by them, they, you know, are still have the right to, you know, hunt, gather, fish, perform ceremonies or whatever on that land. But these oil developments were making that impossible. And these oil developments are also being driven by fossil fuel corporations and governments that were seeking oil profits, so seeking to profit from the land. So at this time, actually, I was living in Brooklyn. I still live in Brooklyn in the same apartment that I was in then. And this was a time, you know, in the in the 2010s, when the anti-gentrification movement was really popping off all around America, you know, cities all around America, but especially in Brooklyn and, you know, in my neighborhood as well. And the sort of loudest part of that narrative about gentrification was that it was, you know, white people moving into poor neighborhoods of color and bringing in their, you know, like matcha oat milk lattes and pretentious $25 cocktail bars or whatever. But the thing that I was noticing when I attended, you know, protests or just events was that I also repeatedly heard residents and activists making sort of a more quiet claim, which is that, yes, so longtime residents of these neighborhoods were being evicted or priced out of their apartments, you know, a process that they had really no control over, you know, like an eviction notice. A landlord would just send an eviction notice in the mail one day and they would receive it. And that's that. But on top of this displacement, the problem a lot of these communities identified was that they were also being ignored and had no voice when they tried to raise concerns about, you know, fancy new commercial or apartment developments being proposed in their neighborhoods. So basically, these communities were saying, we have no control over the lands we've lived in for decades or longer. So obviously, gentrification is like not the same as indigenous dispossession at all. But, you know, I noticed they shared something similar. Like they both talked about how people lack control over the lands they live on and depend and that they depend on, you know, for housing, food, whatever. And I realized that issues over land, so like who owns it, who controls it, who profits from land, who benefits from it, and like decides how land gets used. You know, these questions are really, I realized, at the center of, yeah, all many of the biggest issues of our day. So not just climate and the environment, which was my entryway into the topic, but also, you know, racial justice, inequality, housing, food, and also land. I mean, it wasn't something that was like talked about that much. Like we talked about capitalism or income inequality, wealth, housing, air, water quality, food. We talk about capital even a lot, you know, when we talk about social issues, but like rarely was the issue of land discussed. So that's like why I kind of wanted to understand the critical role that control over land has played in America. And that's kind of what the long story of what kicked off my work on this book.
And it's interesting because, oh, well, you mentioned the indigenous people. I mean, of course, until capitalism, well, that's not necessarily true, but I'd say for most of human prehistory and a large portion even of human history, human beings have lived with a completely different sense of land than is central to capitalism. And that is that land was seen as something to use but not to own. But one of the central tensions in your book actually is how, given that we are now operating and have been operating for, you know, a while in this property-driven system of land ownership, people have been fighting back by using the very same forms of property. Well, they've changed in some ways the property forms of ownership, but ownership of the land is still the way things are being thought about by and large. So talk about how one can use this profoundly unequal way of relating to land in a way that returns sovereignty to people who have been dispossessed.
Yeah, it's a very complicated, complex questions in some ways. And in some ways, it's actually very simple. Yeah, the complexity is that, I mean, we now exist within a legal system that fundamentally views land as property. So something to be owned, and we're the owner, the private owner, or whoever the owner is, even if it's the government, they're the ones that really get the final say over how to use it, how to profit from it. They're kind of like the dictator of their parcel. And so, you know, it's almost impossible now to think about reparative ways of, you know, doing things with the land in a way that repairs these like historically unjust relationships, you know, indigenous dispossession or Black dispossession of land, without just returning to this, like, you know, Black communities or indigenous nations should be owning the lands that they once owned. But for me, one of the ways that I think about this complexity a lot, and one of the ways that I think about this is that, you know, private land ownership, or now home ownership, has always been such a central part of the American ideal, you know, of individual independence, achievement, and stability. It's just like, it's really one of the key components of the American dream, right? But, you know, we've seen with the foreclosure crisis and increasingly unaffordable rents in cities and rural places around the country, and just like the astronomical cost of buying a home, you know, our system that is built on private property ownership, private land ownership, is actually producing the opposite effect. It's like producing instability for communities and even for homeowners and landowners. Regular people are unable to get ahead or keep up with rising rents. They can barely keep up with the cost of maintaining the homes or the land that they own. And at one point I realized, I think what people want is actually not property ownership per se. I mean, a lot of people do want that, sure. What we really want is stability and security in our surroundings and the place we live. We want control over that environment so we can, you know, if it's a house, we can paint it whatever color we want. We can add an addition, you know, to, you know, add another bedroom or whatever, you know, build a shed in our backyard, a pool. we want to, parents or grandparents want to create some family wealth, you know, something that's a value that they can pass on to their children and grandchildren. And this is something that is really, really important in our economic system, where, you know, we don't have like a social safety net for retirement. Our healthcare system is like not, you know, not in the best shape. And so, yeah, it's not really property ownership that people necessarily want. It's like all these other components. And so what I thought, what I realized is that all a bunch of these like communities all around the US who are working towards these like different ways of owning or stewarding or controlling land, many of them were trying to achieve stability, independence, control for individuals and families by sort of spreading the responsibilities and also the like the responsibilities and burdens of ownership, but also like the benefits. So it's a way of kind of democratizing control of land ownership and all the, you know, all the benefits of it and just spreading the burdens. And also keeping costs down, you know, removing parcels from the real estate market and just like the really intense market pressures that, you know, keep pushing up prices every year. So I think, yeah, a lot of these different solutions, that's how they kind of, I suppose, are like trying to square the circle of, you know, this contradiction of having to use the same legal tools that exist right now to try to do something radically different from what it was intended to do.
So let's move to some examples. But first, I want to introduce you to our audience or reintroduce you. We are speaking with Audrey Lim. Her book is Free the Land, How We Can Fight Poverty and Climate Chaos. So yeah, let's talk about, well, you mentioned a project that I'm actually fairly familiar with because my granddaughter's boyfriend works with, every summer he goes and he works on Winona LaDuke's farm up in Minnesota. And he's going to be going out there in July again this year. So tell us about this. I mean, we talked about the dispossession of indigenous lands. This is a case of bringing the land back, the White Earth Land Recovery Project and Winona's Hemp and Heritage Farm.
Yeah, this is a super, super interesting project. I mean, I think a lot of your listeners will probably have heard of Winona LaDuke, who's, you know, this really, really brilliant activist and author and thinker who's like one of the, you know, faces of the indigenous environmental movement. And she, yeah, she grew up in California, but she is part of the White Earth Nation, which is in northern Minnesota. And this White Earth Land Recovery Project that she started in, I think it was the 80s. So it kind of started because she realized that, so one of this idea that I think a lot of people, including myself at one point, have about Native reservations in the US is that there are these like vast stretches of just like unbroken lands that just like belong to indigenous nations. In reality, that's like very much not the case. So for the White Earth Reservation, you know, tribal lands, lands that are owned by the tribe, really only make up like 10% of their reservation. You have like federal lands, including, you know, a national wildlife refuge, national forests. They cover something like 15%. Then the state and counties, they own another like quarter of the reservation. And the rest, I think the other half of the reservation are basically all private lands that are owned by, some of these are individual like tribal members, but it also includes people who are non-native. It includes organizations. It includes companies like big timber companies, big farm companies as well, like big farm corporations. So what she realized when she sort of returned to the reservation in the 80s, she looked around. The federal government had just finished this investigation about all the private lands that were kind of stolen from the White Earth people, the White Earth Nation, and now belonged to, you know, now belong to like white landowners or companies. And they were trying to figure out a way to a federal agreement to sort of pay the White Earth Nation for all of these lands that had been taken from their people, and just like clear up these problems with the property deeds and just resolve all the property issues with it. So Winona LaDuke sort of looked around and she told me she saw, you know, her people like sort of mired in poverty, and they didn't own the vast majority of the land on their own reservation. And she was like, actually, what we need is not just, you know, we don't need like another investigation about, it was like the seventh investigation or something, about how lands had been stolen from her people. She was like, we need actually the land to be returned to our people. And so she like looked around and saw these conservation land trusts, like Trust for Public Land, the Nature Conservancy, that were around the country sort of buying up lands and just preserving it, not developing it, you know, not farming it or anything. And she was like, oh, so like, why can't we get people to give some of our land back, or these organizations who say they support us, to help us buy back the land? And like, you should help us, because, you know, as she joked, she was like, your team stole it from us. So she created this organization called the White Earth Land Recovery Project. And she, you know, she made appeals to local newspapers and radio stations and stuff, explaining the project and explaining, yeah, this is what we're about. And like, could you help us with it? So people actually started donating money to help them buy land. A few people started donating land back to them, lands that were on the reservation, but that, you know, for whatever reason they held and were not using. It was basically land that was just sitting vacant. And so they, you know, started acquiring some of this land that was just like new parcels that were on the reservation. These are private lands on the reservation. And then her board members, you know, as they started like building out this, I guess, a land portfolio, her board members told her, well, you can't, the whole point is not just for you to own the land, right? To just like add, we're not just trying to create like a real estate portfolio and just sit on the land. You need to do something with it. So she created a, there's like a store. They have farmland, and they have like organic raspberry bush, maple sugar bush, which is like forests for harvesting maple syrup. And, you know,
and they, wild rice.
Yes. And wild rice and stuff like that. They started a store. They launched a store called, I think, Native Harvest, that sells some of the maple syrup and, you know, raspberries and whatever, along with a bunch of other things that just people in the community make. You know, there were Gotland hoodies. They sold some of this wild rice. And you can, you know, you can go online and you can buy it. Now, one of their properties is like an old elementary schoolhouse that's on the reservation that used to belong to a nearby county or something. So they have like a store there now. You can go there and buy these things and support them. There's like a recording studio in there for a radio station that's like for the community as well. And yeah, they do a bunch of just different kinds of food and agriculture work on the farm. For instance, Winona LaDuke and a lot of the farmers that are like part of the project, but also just in that community, have been like trying to grow out some of these traditional foods, like types of corn that used to be a really central part of the diet and used to grow in the region. But, you know, the whole region is now monocrop farming of potatoes and stuff. So they started to like try to grow out some of these traditional foods, and then like teach local people to grow them in their gardens. So yeah, that's the project.
Now, another agricultural project that I found so interesting in this book, in Free the Land, How We Can Fight Poverty and Climate Chaos, Audrea Lim, it was a project with Somali farmers. First, tell us what is happening to farmland. What made it so difficult for this group of Somali Bantu families to farm? And then you can tell us, you know, how they saved their farming project.
Yeah, this is a super, super interesting project. So people often talk about there's like a crisis in There's a farm crisis, but there's part of that is also that there's a farmland crisis. So when it comes to America's like private farmlands, there's been like a massive concentration of land ownership since the Great Recession. So I think the land holdings of America's like 100 largest private owners has increased from 28 million to like 42 million acres just since 2008. And some of these owners include, you know, timber companies or big farm companies, as well as like conservation groups, Ted Turner, Bill Gates. And we have like an estimated 370 million acres of farmland that's like expected to change hands by 2035. So that's like 10 years from now. This is as an old generation of farmers retire and just like need to sell off the main source of wealth that they own. But the problem is that small farmers, you know, who grow table food, small farmers from marginalized communities, like the Somali Bantu farmers in Maine, they're just being outbid by big corporations and like financial investors. They just simply don't have the cash to compete in this market. And it's not even just that they can't compete in the market. It's also that the costs are just surging. They've been spiking, I mean, for several decades, but especially since the pandemic. You know, I think there was like an 8% increase in the cost of land from just 2020 to 2021. And on top of this, you know, American farmland is being lost to development, like urban development, at a very, very fast rate. And, you know, climate change is also is starting to transform these areas that were used to be very fertile soil. And these are becoming barren or unfarmable. And this is just going to shrink the supply of farmland a lot further and probably also increase the cost of land. So the Somali Bantu farmers that you asked about, this is a community that they're from Somalia. They fled during the civil war. Many of them wound up in refugee camps for a long time and then landed in the US. And some of them found their way to Maine. So the one activist or community leader I spoke to, his name is Liba. And he's been in the area, I think, for probably 20 years or something. And so he talked about how back in Somalia, you know, farming is basically like what his people did, what his family did. And it was like they're from the this very fertile area of Somalia called like the Juba Valley around the Juba River. And this land was like super fertile. They grew their own food. They could catch, you know, fish from the river. And for the most part, they grew things to eat for themselves. And then they would just sell off the rest at the market, anything that was excess. Or if there were like people in the community that just like needed some food, had a rough year on their farm, maybe they would just give away some of their food. So it's a very big part of their culture, and they wanted to be able to farm. So when they first started arriving, the community just wanted to, you know, it's Maine. They could see it was just green farmland in all directions that they looked. They're based out of Lewiston. But, you know, they were saying, oh, we didn't know how to do it. We didn't know, like, who to contact. We didn't have any money. They managed to get some land to rent through people that they knew. And so these, like, farm plots, they basically made them into community farms, you know, like, subdivided these plots into smaller plots for individual families to have their own little garden or farm plot. And they also had these farm cooperatives of just, like, about two or four farmers who sort of ran a farm cooperative together, and then they would like sell what they grew at a marketplace or to local businesses or whatever. And so those are the people that were using their farms. The problem is that they found themselves, they had a few rented plots, and they kept having to leave them and find new plots. So I think since in the last like 10 years, they had to move like six times or something. That meant that like they have to every single time they have to like move, you know, any irrigation systems, any like storage systems that they have, they just move the whole operation and start again from new every single time. And this is a struggle, I guess, for land security that small farmers, table farmers around the U.S. share. It's not just them. So this was the problem that they faced.
So tell us about, the equity trust. What is it? Tell us about the equity trust that came in and how they organized themselves on this model.
Yeah. So it started about 10 years ago. It was basically some like farm nonprofits and the Schumacher Center for New Economics. They gathered, and Greenhorns, which is like a nonprofit that supports young farmers. They gathered like a group of farmers and farm advocates. And their big question that they were trying to solve was like, what's a solution, a proactive solution to this farmland crisis? How do we protect farmland while also distributing ownership more broadly? And so the solution that they kind of turned to is known as the Community Land Trust. So this is basically a model of land ownership that was pioneered in the U.S. Like in the U.S., it was pioneered by Black farmers in Southwest Georgia in the civil rights era. Now it's mostly known as an affordable housing model. But basically how it works is that the land itself is owned by a community, by a nonprofit that in turn is like controlled entirely by community members. So individual residents or, maybe businesses like a farm co-op or whatever that uses the land. Some of the people that control it might also be a local nonprofit or organization. Sometimes it's just local community leaders. So it's community controlled and owned land. But on top of that, whatever gets built on top of it, so that can be houses, or it could be a farm business, it could be a community center, it could be whatever it is, those things can be privately owned. So it's a model that, spreads the benefits and burdens or responsibilities of land ownership between a community, but then allows for private ownership of something, a business, a house, an asset that allows individual owners or businesses to build wealth. So this group of farm advocates, they decided to do this, to go back to this model that was initially pioneered for farmland ownership, at least in the States. And they launched this organization called the Agrarian Trust, which is like a nonprofit. And so what the Agrarian Trust has done is that they've created these agrarian commons. I'm not sure exactly how many the number is expanding, but they might have about like a dozen different agrarian commons around the country now. There's one in Minnesota, where the White Earth Land Recovery Project is located. And that one is, still being developed, but you have a bunch of different organizations and different farmers from, indigenous farmers, Black farmers, Latinx farmers who are coming together and figuring out, can we have this land that's owned by the commons, which we as community members, we will control. We sit on the board and we'll control the land. But then we can have our own nonprofit or private farm businesses on top. So in Lewiston, Maine, the Agrarian Trust, they started talking to LIBA and the members of like farmers with the Somali Bantu community. And one of the agrarian commons is the Little Jubba Maine Agrarian Commons, I think is what it's called. In this case, the Somali Bantu, they have a community association. They're kind of the sole business beneficiary of the land that's owned by this community. So, of course, the community members sit on the board for this CLT, this Agrarian Commons. The nonprofit organization, the Agrarian Trust, also sits on the board of this organization. So they can together sort of steward the land, decide on how much rent, to charge any of the people who use the land. So that can be the community farmers or whatever. But then whatever gets built on top of the land, that can be owned by, the Somali Bantu Community Association. And so now they have this plot of land that has been placed forever, basically, in this trust, the Agrarian Commons, and it's controlled by the community. And so they've sort of achieved this balance of, allowing people to start private businesses or nonprofit organization, have a community farm on this plot of land, but it's controlled by the community and like protected from the pressures of the market.
Now, Audrey Lim, you mentioned before you talked about gentrification, there's another model in your book, the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. This isn't community land trust, but there's a community planning organizing. Talk about the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative and what problem it solves.
It actually is a community land trust. Yes, it started as a planning initiative. So basically what happened in, I think it was also in the mid-80s, this is in Boston in the Roxbury community that's mainly sort of African-American, Cape Verdean immigrants, Latinx, and white. And basically the city of Boston came up with this plan for urban development for this area called the Dudley Triangle within their neighborhood. And the residents had already been organizing a lot around these like illegal waste transfer sites in their neighborhood. And so they had been successful and they, I think, had a real sense of their own power as an organizing force. And so when the city of Boston approached them, or they didn't even approach them, I think a plan of their urban development plan leaked. The residents of this community were like, oh no, this is not what we want. We don't want, you know, fancy new office developments that are going to end up displacing us. So what they did instead was they drafted their own plan with, you know, the support of this charity that had already started helping them out during the, you know, process of like fighting these waste transfer sites. And they not only through organizing, you know, they not only drafted their own plan, but they convinced the city to adopt it, convinced the city to give them, it was like over $100 million to roll out the plan. They gave the organization, the community, DSNI, Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, all of the vacant city lands within the 60-acre area known as the Dudley Triangle. And they even delegated their powers of eminent domain to the organization to like buy up the unused vacant private lands within the triangle from like absentee owners. And what they did was they put these lands in a community land trust. They started to act as a developer. They built a ton of affordable housing. So some of these are like single family homes. There's like fourplexes, duplexes. And these were much less expensive than houses that are going for market price because the land is placed in community control and placed in this community land trust called Dudley Neighbors Initiative. So, you know, it was significantly cheaper. And if one of those homeowners ended up wanting to sell it, it could go to somebody else who is, you know, within the neighborhood or somebody who just like didn't make enough money to be able to buy something market rate. But on top of that, because the community controls so much land, like basically half the land within this triangle, they have been able to develop all sorts of other things in the neighborhood that make it a really, really nice neighborhood. There's a ton of green space. There's really well-maintained parks and urban farms and community gardens all around the neighborhood that are really nice, you know, and that people use to just chill and, you know, hang out, but also to grow food and whatever. They just acquired a very large commercial building that's going to be like an art and cultural space that's going to be part of this like new arts and culture district that the community also helped to envision. And, you know, it's like, in large part, this model was the CLT, Community Land Trust model, gave them a way, was an instrument for them to control the land and actually bring this vision to fruition. And they won the government support, the financial support from government as well as charities to bring this plan to fruition. They did that through community organizing. And yeah, it's incredibly powerful, their story. And it gave me a lot of hope just visiting it and learning about it.
Yes, exactly. I mean, with so much that can inspire despair around us that we hear every day. It is really wonderful to read not just of things that people can do, but of the kinds of things that people, neighbors, communities have done to work within a system that, you know, has been so implacable in dispossessing them and take back sovereignty. Your book is Free the Land, How We Can Fight Poverty and Climate Chaos. There are many, many more examples. You go to Puerto Rico. You explore some of the contradictions of, say, the conservation movement, land conservation movement. There are many more things that we didn't have the time to cover. I highly recommend this book to my listeners. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Audrea Lim is a Brooklyn-based journalist who's written for The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, The New Republic, and The Nation. In addition to Free the Land, she's the author of the book The World We Need, Stories and Lessons from America's Unsung Environmental Movement. Next up, we go way back to 2009 to listen to our interview with Carlene Madigan about her book The Backyard Homestead. Stay tuned. After the break. The Garden Song by David Mallet and performed by David Grover and the Big Bear Band. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice, or go to writersvoice.net, or go to writersvoice.net for links. Now, let's listen to my 2009 interview with Carlene Madigan about her book, The Backyard Homestead. A bestseller, it inspired a whole series of backyard homestead books. With as little as a quarter acre, you can harvest 1,400 eggs, 50 pounds of wheat, 60 pounds of fruit, 2,000 pounds of vegetables, and 75 pounds of nuts. That's a lot of food on the table. You've only got a little balcony, you say? No problem. Some tomatoes, peppers, and lettuce grow better in containers. And you can preserve your harvest to enjoy through the winter. It's all laid out in a great little guide by my guest, Carlene Madigan. Her book is The Backyard Homestead. You know, your wonderful book, The Backyard Homestead, the subtitle is Produce All the Food You Need on a Quarter Acre. A quarter acre? How?
Yes. With a lot of work. it is possible, especially if you're just one or two people in your family. But I do like to remind people to start off small with, you know, if you've never gardened before, just try, you know, one bed or even one plant in a container to get going and dip your toe in before you go off whole hog. It's a great dream to be able to grow all of your own food and keep chickens and honeybees and all of that. And you can definitely get to that point, but it's a good idea to start off small.
Well, as you said, you can start very small, even with container gardening. And you point out that in the case of certain vegetables, you actually can produce more with a container garden. Talk a little bit about that.
That's true, especially with, you know, living in a cold climate where we do. It's hard to get enough heat for plants like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants. And especially if you're using what's called a self-watering container to give the plant a very steady supply of water. Even if you're not using a self-watering container, just having those kinds of heat-loving plants in containers raises the soil moisture, the soil temperature, which helps them produce a lot better than they would if they were in the ground.
A self-watering container now, is this something that you have to buy or can you actually make them yourself?
You can make them yourself. It's basically just the idea of bottom watering. So if you go online to, or even at your local garden center, I think they sell these kits for houseplants. Like when you go away on vacation, it's kind of it's hard to explain, but it basically works by capillary action. So you're running a wick from the soil of the container you're growing in into a kind of a bucket of water. So it keeps the moisture supply constant. The self-watering containers that you buy are just a more elaborate version of that.
Obviously, you can, you know, make your choice of vegetables, but what are some of the general principles of putting in a backyard homestead? And first of all, explain what you mean by homestead.
Well, I like to say that the backyard homestead is as much a state of mind as it is an actual place. So it's all of the skills that you can learn about in the backyard homestead. It's not just about the physical act of growing vegetables or raising animals, but it's also about the process of making food. So making cheese and making your own sausage. And you can do those things whether or not you raise animals or grow your own vegetables. So you can make cheese whether or not you milk a goat, but you can certainly learn how. But I think that some of the basic things to start with are just, you know, looking at the exposure your yard has. So how much sun do you get every day? Vegetables and most fruiting plants also need quite a lot of sun. Also talk to your neighbors, especially if you're interested in keeping animals. I mean, that's a really big commitment. You should consider it much like getting a pet. If you were going to get a dog, you wouldn't just say, hey, I'm going to go run out and pick up a dog from the shelter and bring it home. You really have to consider what your lifestyle is like and how much time and effort you want to put into taking care of the animal. And with farm animals in particular, there are a lot of, you know, towns that don't allow you to keep chickens or pigs or other animals within the city limit. So you have to be very careful about that too. So I definitely recommend that people start with just a very simple vegetable garden, maybe a few strawberry plants. Make sure you have good soil, get a load of compost delivered, and just go for it. Don't be afraid. People are afraid to kill something that they plant. But I really just encourage people to not think about the rules and just kind of dive in and have fun and see what happens. And if something goes wrong, use it as an opportunity to learn about the plant and what you can do better next time.
Well, Carlene Madigan, in your book, The Backyard Homestead, you actually have plans for homesteads of different sizes. So give us an idea. How much could you grow on a quarter acre? How much could you grow or have, because it's not just growing, it's also raising animals, on a half an acre? Give us a sense of the difference between the two.
Well, I consulted with a number of authors when I was putting this book together, and in particular, these plans that we have for, you know, how to set up your homestead on different sizes of property. And I was kind of surprised. I was chatting with Carolee Carius, who has written a number of poultry books for us, and it's surprising how many chickens, in particular, you can have on a fairly small piece of property. So she told me that it's pretty easy to have 6 chickens in just a small corner of a tenth of an acre lot. And 6 chickens, if you think about it, in their prime production, produce about an egg a day. It's a little bit less than that. But so an egg a day from 6 chickens is a lot of eggs a week. So you're getting half a dozen eggs a day. So what we did was we took all of these ballpark calculations of what you can produce from a vegetable garden of a certain size and keeping a couple of pigs and a couple of chickens. And the back cover goes through how much you can produce of each of these things. So from a quarter of an acre, you can get something in the neighborhood of 1,400 eggs in a year, 2,000 pounds of vegetables, 280 pounds of pork, 75 pounds of nuts, and 60 pounds of fruit. And of course, all of these things are highly dependent on where you live, the kind of climate you have, how much rain you get, and certainly with the vegetables, what kinds of vegetables you grow. If you grow a lot of potatoes and things that are heavy, you can get to 2,000 pounds pretty quickly. So,
now, this also depends on how much time you have. I mean, is this like a full-time occupation to raise the kind of food that you're talking about on a quarter acre, or is this something that somebody who has a job could actually do?
There are definitely parts of this that anybody can do, depending on your level of interest. I always like to refer to a family that I read about online in Pasadena, California, and they have a website called The Path to Freedom. And it's a family of four. They're gardening on, I think it's a tenth of an acre, and they have a few, you know, small animals also, dairy goats and chickens mostly, and they grow enough of their own food to feed their entire family, and they have a small business supplying restaurants and a local CSA. So it is possible, but really that is their full-time job. I'm not sure most people would kind of go to that level, but you can do an awful lot. And if you start with things like berry bushes or strawberries, things that are perennial, so plants that will come back every year, once you get the beds prepared and get some good compost in there and get the plants in and well mulched, there's really very little to do every year besides weeding and picking the berries and keeping an eye out for certain pests and diseases. But if you choose your plants correctly or wisely, you shouldn't have too much of a problem with that.
I lived in a little village in France for about 8 months in 2001, 2002.
Oh, nice.
And there was about 100 people who lived in that village. And one of the people there did raise chickens, and he raised them in a little plot of land that was right smack in the center of the village. And he solicited from his neighbors scraps, kitchen scraps. Mm. And anybody who would give him kitchen scraps, which you would just go and throw in, you know, when you had them, he would then come around and give you eggs. And I thought that that was a lovely example of how you can share the burden and share the wealth as well.
Absolutely. I love that kind of community operation. I think it's true. I think that you can achieve a lot more with that kind of community action and community support.
You also in your book talk about such pleasurable activities as wine, beer, and beer making. This is also something you can do from your own homestead?
You can. Certain parts of the beer making process, so you can grow your own hops. And recently, I think in the past year or two, there's been quite a hops shortage in the world. So the backyard hops growers have been in a good place. You can grow your own hops. You can grow barley to malt for the beer making process. Even easier than that is winemaking, because you can do that from any number of different kinds of fruit. My dad used to make a blackberry wine from blackberries that he foraged, and that was really delicious. So this year it's kind of on my list of things that I want to do is try winemaking.
And there's been a terrible devastation of beehives, especially commercial beehives. You talk about growing backyard hives. Talk about that. I mean, is there a danger of colony collapse disorder in backyard hives, or are they a little bit more resilient for this, resistant?
From what I understand, any hive can be susceptible to colony collapse disorder. But certainly there's a lot of concern, particularly in industrial orchards where they kind of cart bees from one location to the next. So you can certainly do your own part in keeping your own vegetable garden healthy and productive, and you know, the gardens in your neighborhood by keeping a beehive. I think a lot of people don't realize the role that bees play in producing food for us, not just honey, but in pollinating all of the plants that then produce food for us. So if there were no bees, you wouldn't have any vegetables or fruit. So that's really one thing that you can do. And also the honey is good too. So
all of this sounds like it might be very complicated. I mean, in your book, The Backyard Homestead, it's really a how-to book. You've got a lot of wonderful tips about a huge array of things, from raising chickens and pigs and goats, and milking them, by the way, and then making cheese, doing gardens, doing hives. Is this really something that one can learn from a book like yours, or does it take a whole lot more training to do that?
I think The Backyard Homestead is a good starting point for people, and that's really how I conceived of the idea, was to get the most basic starter information from each of those topics and compile them into one place for people who are just interested in getting started in it but don't know where to go right off the bat. So I think that anybody can pick up this book and be inspired by what's in it and then want to go out and learn more from other books. You're not going to find everything you need to know to raise goats or chickens in this book, but it's a good starting point and you can kind of move out from there to learn more. But certainly anybody can do this.
And the book is The Backyard Homestead. Produce all the food you can eat on just a quarter acre. Carlene Madigan says you can get as much as 1,400 eggs, 50 pounds of wheat, 60 pounds of fruit, 2,000 pounds of vegetables, 280 pounds of pork, and 75 pounds of nuts just from a backyard homestead. Carlene Madigan, thanks so much for coming in and talking about your book, The Backyard Homestead.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Carlene Madigan. She spoke with us in 2009. And Writer's Voice just turned 20. Yep, we've been on the air since July 2004. I never imagined I'd still be doing it 20 years later, but it's a labor of love. This is our 928th episode. Go to writersvoice.net to explore our archives. We have so many treasures there. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.